Hello and welcome. You're listening to Fourth Estate, the show where journalists talk journalism. Coming to you from 2SER in Sydney on Gadigal lands of the Eora Nation, right across Australia on the Community Radio Network, and directly to your device across the globe via podcast, the podcast app of your choice. My name is Peter Frey, the co-director of the Centre for Media Transition at the University of Technology, Sydney, and my producer is Anthony Dockrell, and a very big thank you to him. It's great for the Fourth Estate to be back on air after a two-week spell, in which 2SER hopefully made lots of money. Tonight, we've got a very special edition of the show. We're going to look at, what I think is one of the most interesting and arguably most important pieces of journalism of the year so far, and talk to the journo behind it. What I'm talking about, if you haven't guessed, is Teacher's Pet by the irrepressible, dogged, highly skilled, multi-skilled Hedley Thomas from The Australian. Hello, Hedley.
G'day, Peter. What an intro. Thank you.
Well, you richly deserve it, mate. Richly deserve it. Hedley's coming to us from the on the line from Brisbane. And let's get straight into it, mate. Let's talk about this cracking yarn. It's a crime story, or an alleged crime, I suppose. It's got some very, very dark secrets inside of it. There's a woman is missing, presumed dead. We have no body, even though two coronial inquests have concluded that murder was afoot. And the prime suspect is the missing woman's ex-husband is free. And that's the kind of guts of the yarn. But then putting a little journalistic hat on, to my mind, Teacher's Pet has the potential to change how we think about how great journalism is done, certainly great podcasting, and also the role of the audience in helping to do this, because they've been really central to the success of this story. Teacher's Pet, just to cite a few stats, has 26 million downloads. Is that right, Hedley?
That's right, yeah.
26 million. When you started, did you think, oh my God, I'm going to get 26 million downloads?
No, Peter, I thought that anything that might, get into six figures, like 100,000 odd, would be fantastic, because I'd spent months on the story and I was getting really worried that I'd used up a lot of work time and expenses flying to Sydney and Newcastle and elsewhere pursuing the yarn. And we do these things carefully on a budget. There isn't rivers of gold running through the newspaper industry anymore, so it had to be very diligently managed. But anything, in the six-figure mark would have just been unreal. And then it just started taking off, and the trajectory got really steep, and to the point where we're now doing, download-wise, about 1 million a week.
It's incredible, isn't it?
Most of which is overseas now.
Yes, that's right. You are now an international star. I'm humbled to be speaking to you. We'll go to the yarn in a minute, but one of the interesting things that people always ask me, or students and people who are not journalists ask me, is kind of how do these things start? It's all a bit of a mystery, isn't it? So how did you pick this one? I mean, I know you had a bit of a personal connection, but that wasn't massive, right? But maybe talk us through, the personal connection and how, what made you go, yes, this is a yarn I need to tell?
Mm. I first picked this story in late February, early March, 17 years ago.
Oh, wow. So
that's where it goes back. It goes back to 2001. And I remember sitting at my desk at the Courier Mail newspaper in Brisbane and reading brief newspaper articles about the first inquest into Lyn Dawson's presumed death. And the story then gripped me because, it appeared to have the elements of a travesty of justice, an incredible drama, a very sad story about two daughters being raised, believing that their mother didn't love them enough and therefore walked away. Mm. And a footballer who was their father, Lyn's husband, who had been besotted with and in love with a schoolgirl who'd be taught, moving that girl into the house soon afterwards. And so the story then really got me. And I went to Sydney back then and pursued it, and did a large weekend feature read after spending most of the day in the police station on the northern beaches reading the files that had come back from the coronial proceedings that had just finished.
So that was the first. That was the first coronial inquest, right?
That was, and that was the first taste I had of the story.
Yeah.
And I discovered through reading those files so much more than I'd read in just the AAP newspaper reports of it. And as a result of that, I wanted one day to revisit it. I found emails, in fact, that I wrote way back then, where I was considering writing a book about the case because it was so extraordinary. And over the years, you know, I stayed in touch with Lynn's sister Pat, who I met when I went to Sydney in 2001, and also Greg Sims, Lynn's brother.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, we fast forward to the end of last year, 2017. It was about this time, in fact, that I decided I needed to do something completely different in my own journalism
mm-hmm.
to keep me fired up about journalism, Peter. I was mm-hmm. probably, like a lot of journalists, you get to a certain stage where it all feels sometimes a little...
Yeah, you've done a lot of yarns. You've done a lot of heavy lifting.
And you're looking for something, this story, but with a different medium, you know, with this podcast platform that I'd started listening to and I was attracted to, and I wrote to Lynn's family asking them how they would feel about cooperating with me in a major investigation that I would deliver via podcast, and they didn't know what a podcast was. I couldn't reassure them that I could do one because I didn't have any track record in it, but you know, with goodwill, we just agreed to give it a crack and we got started.
And away you went.
Ooh,
what was the, if you hadn't won the trust, the cooperation and cooperation of Lynn's family, would you still have done it, you think?
I don't think so. Because I think when you commit, as I wanted to, completely to a story on this scale, you have to know that the people closest to Lynn are backing you up, are interested and invested in you doing your job. Mm. And if they had said no thanks, I believe that it would have been impossible to do justice to the story, because I needed to unpick as much as I could from their own brains, their own experiences, to their own files. And I couldn't have done that if they just said, no, we're not going to participate. We've done as much as we want to do on this.
And that's one of the interesting things that comes through in listening to Teacher's Pet is the, in a sense, even though some of the subjects know this story backwards and probably think about it most days of their life, in the process of interviewing, it comes fresh and new again, and they actually have new insights.
It's a
fascinating
right.
thing to actually hear it, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and I think Greg and Pat, and siblings, although they've lived with this story for, you know, since their sister went missing 36 years ago, they've discovered so much new material as a result of me sharing with them things that I've found.
Mm.
And because I became pretty relentlessly focused on the files, the statements, the transcripts, all of the evidence, and I read it until I had almost memorized it, hundreds of pages of stuff, and I was seeing things with fresh eyes that they hadn't considered before. And, you know, it was this, I think, wonderful kind of collaboration that we were able to have that helped, again, discover new angles.
Well, I was going to talk to you about that. So the collaborative aspect of this is really fascinating, isn't it? Because it's not just the family. You have opened up this case and you have amassed an incredible amount of material. And one of the fascinating things about listening to the Teacher's Pet as you go on is you're kind of on this journey with you, right? And you don't really know when it's going to end.
So and I didn't know.
You didn't know. So did you? Yeah. So how? Just to talk us through that. So you, you know, people started emailing you, giving you tips, that sort of stuff.
Yeah. Well, I guess I, in my mind, I knew that I wanted to tell this big story, and because I hadn't done a podcast before, I wasn't kind of bound by, I don't know, podcast industry rules, if there are any. You know, I just, I'd written a book before about a decade ago, and perhaps in my mind I saw this unfolding a bit like a book, in that I wanted to tell it with a lot of richness and detail and evidence and colour. But I also perhaps was at the same time approaching it like a newspaper journalist who wants to start a series but hasn't written the whole series when the first part of the series is published. So when I decided that we should launch the podcast episodes, I'd only written a very small number of episodes, and we only had recorded and had all the material prepared for, I think, you know, 1.5 or maximum 2. Yeah,
only had a couple of apps in the bag, right? Okay.
Yeah, that's right. But I felt that because I had already done so many, you know, probably a couple of hundreds of hours of interviews with people, I felt that I would be able to rely on that and build and write the scripts and roll out the episodes with the buffer that we've built up of a couple, you know, about three. But I thought that that might generate some material, but I don't think that was the overriding reason when I said, let's go ahead. I think I was just wanting to get started, because you know what it's like with journos. If they keep pushing the deadline out, they don't get started.
You got to need a deadline, right?
Yeah, you have to have a deadline. And I just thought, I'm starting to get stage fright. And if I don't start this soon, I'm going to keep putting it off. And if I keep putting it off, I'll get more stage fright, because it'll be more time that I've spent on this thing, and my editors are starting to look at me sideways, and I really need to push ahead. So that's what happened. And then as a result of people listening and having this this story just remind them of where they were, what they saw, what they knew, they started contacting me, and then I needed to include what they told me once I'd verified it and corroborated it, and that became part of, you know, the early episodes and the ongoing episodes. And then more people heard new people coming out, and they realized that the series was not all pre-produced
Yeah, it wasn't all done. It wasn't a Netflix
series.
Yeah,
like it was being written in the days before it was released, and so they felt that they could respond to the last episode and help me, and so many people did that, and it became this incredible snowball. And
I really like the model. Yeah, it's a great model, right? It's live reporting.
Yeah, the model is fantastic, but it's a high wire act. Like it's really risky and exhausting, and you know you're alive when you're doing it.
Well, it's a bit like this wonderful show, The Fourth Estate, on CSI. Not quite, mate, not quite. Tell us, just dwell on podcasting for a second, because, as a journalist, what have you learned about podcasting? From, you know, what are the qualities and the pitfalls in this in podcasting? Because everyone seems to want to do one these days.
Yeah, what I've learned is that you don't need to get hung up about audio quality, because a lot of my audio is pretty rough. Mm-hmm. You know, you'll have me doing interviews with people, and you can hear a dog barking, you can hear, planes overhead, you hear the diesel engine of my car because I've got, you know, the little H2N zoom on the dashboard. So it's not about audio quality. Obviously, the audio needs to be easily heard. You don't want to have people straining their ears, and you don't want to have levels that are all over the place. But for me, it's about the story.
Okay, so you don't have to be a technical podcasting whiz to do a podcast. Yeah.
No, and I suspect that a lot of people have got unnecessarily hung up on technical audio quality and getting the most pristine sound out of their device. The teacher's pet has some really good audio and some pretty raw audio. For the most part, I would say it's raw. And I think that that, if anything, has probably helped the story because it's underlined that it's authentic, it's original, it's a journalist without a lot of time, rushing between appointments, telephone calls, interviews, doing a lot in his car because that's just the most effective use of his time, and it worked. Much more important in my view than the audio is storytelling and just being thorough and rigorous and conducting interviews where the interviewee, is really important and the interviewer isn't overbearing. And I think also trying to be measured. Some of the things that I was told and that I discovered, I found stunning, shocking. And a few times I'm sure I became quite affected by it, but I think it's important to stay measured and not fall into the trap that probably TV tabloid journalism can do, which is over-dramatize things, because it's a long series. You don't want people to think that, this is being hyped up or beaten up for ratings. You just want them to stay with the story and believe in it.
That's the kind of the paradox, isn't it, in a way? I mean, you've got massive ratings, 26 million downloads, and part of what it was you were incredibly authentic, is what you're saying, right?
Well, I tried to be authentic. I don't know how to be any other way when I'm doing something like this. So, I didn't, I really didn't know much about what I was doing in terms of the podcast medium, Peter. I just knew that if I applied, or I hoped that if I applied the rules or the things that you and I have learned in long careers in journalism to this, then we would be okay because they're fundamental principles. Try to be fair, try to listen carefully and let people tell their own story, try to be measured in the delivery of the story, try to ensure that parts of the story, are interesting, don't sort of bury the lead, and all of that, perhaps just came through because that's what we practiced in our craft in newspaper reporting.
Yeah. Tell me, but there's one interesting difference. Well, not necessarily a massive difference, but is that in a podcast series, you can't help but be, you're a character in your own series, right? You are Hadley Thomas on this incredible yarn. You're a seeker, a live seeker, right? So that's a slight difference from what we've done previously, right? Where we've been the almost the anonymous journalist in a way.
Yeah, definitely it is. And, I struggle at times with the story being also about me. It's not about me, but I'm the agent, I'm the delivery agent, the messenger for the story. So again, it's balance, and there are arguments for more of that, less of that. I was lucky that I worked with a guy called Slade Gibson who. He's not a journalist, but if he were, he'd be a fantastic journalist. He's a musician and an audio engineer, and he put together the podcasts in terms of the all the audio. And he and I would discuss my scripts every other day, and then he would help me work out what to cut. And between us, we were able to hopefully strike a reasonable balance so that, I didn't come in too much or too little.
Mm-hmm.
But it's always different. Everyone's going to have different tastes.
Of course. Yeah. Well, and that's right. Well, that's the beauty of it in a way, I suppose. Tell me, you talked about sort of balance and those sorts of things. Did you have any ethical conflicts in this story?
I think that one of the challenges early on for me was how to deal with my view of Chris Dawson's alleged guilt. And I have believed since I read the file 17 years ago that he murdered his wife. Mm. And he has always absolutely and quite categorically rejected that and said it's untrue. Two coroners have made that finding, and the police are of that view, and they've never had another suspect. Mind you, they didn't investigate him over it for many years, so he wasn't accused of foul play for at least a decade after his wife disappeared. But I approached the story believing him to have done this, whereas I think in a lot of other stories that we'll do, crime stories, you're probably sitting on the fence for a while. And so ethically for me, there's a dilemma there. Is my view of his guilt going to taint or colour the way I handle the story, the witnesses, the evidence? And I decided that I couldn't change my view. Mm-hmm. So the best way for me to deal with that was to be pretty upfront with the listeners early on. And so they heard from me in episode one, saying what I believed had happened, and I didn't overstate it, but it was put out there, and I think that if I had come across any evidence that tended to exonerate or absolve Chris or point to another party being responsible for Lynn's death, then there's absolutely no doubt I would have gone really hard on that and made that a big focus. But I didn't find anything like that. If, in fact, I found lots of evidence that further reinforced for me the strong view that he murdered Lynn, and that's where it ended up. But I did do a couple of things because Chris wouldn't talk to me, and he didn't want to give his side of the story, and his brother Paul didn't want to either, and his other brother Peter, who was their lawyer, refused to cooperate. So none of them wanted to give the alternative version. So I asked a leading criminal barrister who has defended many alleged murderers to come up with a defense argument that would address some of the evidence and attack some of the witnesses against Chris Dawson, and that became part of episode 14 because I felt that he needed to have someone saying, well, this is how you would try to show that Chris Dawson has been wronged and is not a guilty man.
I think that's a very effective way of doing it. Have you received any legal threats from the Dawson side?
No, not a one.
Right, interesting. And the other person, correct me if I'm wrong, but Joanne Curtis never spoke to you either, right?
No, she was going to.
Right.
So I had been talking to her through her close friend.
For the listeners, Joanne Curtis was Chris Dawson's teenage lover who became his wife.
That's right.
Lynn Dawson disappeared.
She first met him as a year 11 student at Cromer High School, and they began a sexual relationship then, and it continued, and she was the babysitter in the house, and then was moved in after Lynn disappeared. In fact, she moved in for a while Lynn was living there, and then Lynn threw her out after a month when she realised the affair that was going on. But Joanne wanted to talk to me initially, and we discussed that, and I remember in January considering the travel options for me to go to Sydney to meet her and do hours of interviews with her. And then she withdrew completely from that, and I didn't hassle her.
What a great
Yeah, it was. But I also felt that the course of the lengthy interview that she'd given to Damien Lune, the police officer, and the tape of that I had obtained, I felt that her story was still being very comprehensively told, and in some ways, her story was more authentic because she was telling it on that tape, which was a recording of a police interview from 1998, and therefore, arguably, because the events that she was describing were closer to Lynn's disappearance than in 2018, it was more authentic.
Fair point. One of the fascinating in the sense, oh my God, isn't this an incredible culture that you've exposed, but that was happening, you know, in the on the northern beaches of Sydney around this time, the sort of the culture of the sporting hero, the handsome teacher, the police and the high school. It kind of gives you an insight into a particular type of Australia. Is that what you were getting when you were doing that?
Yeah, for sure. And it was summarized by a few of the people I interviewed. And I'm thinking in particular of Julie Andrew, who was Lynn's neighbor up at Bayview. And she talked about how she just knew that Lynn had been murdered. And they were friends, and Lynn suddenly disappeared. And she was telling me that it was surprising to her that the police had never come to see her. They'd never gone to knock on her door to ask her about her friend Lynn and where had she disappeared. What did she know anything about her disappearance? And I asked Julie, well, did you consider just going to the police and reporting what you suspected? And her answer was along the lines of, why would I, as a woman then of, in my late 20s, why would I think that they would listen to me or that I would know more than the authorities? And she went on to talk about how back then, you trusted the police, you trusted the judiciary, you trusted your doctor. If they told you something was fine, it was fine, And so she felt that she didn't have the power or wouldn't be taken seriously by a male-dominated police force to do this, to take it forward. And so she, as she said, just got on with my life. And that really surprised me in a way, because it was repeated by others. Mm. And I think that in this era, when we have such incredible connectivity, with Twitter and Facebook and so on, if we know somebody who goes missing, nobody, if they're suspicious of the circumstances, will be concerned about posting something on Facebook.
No, you put it on Twitter and say, have you seen my friend?
Yeah, exactly. and it's all very transparent and it's instant and so on. Not then. And it's also stunning that you're talking about the wife of a former celebrity footballer. She wasn't a person unknown in the community or in a tiny little country town where they weren't connected. She was a mum of two little girls. She had she had relationships in her workplace, and her family loved her. I'm talking about her siblings and her mum and dad. Good family, grew up in Clovelly near the waves, and yet still, there wasn't a public song and dance.
That's interesting. No outrage. Where was the outrage? when it happened. It does speak of the culture at the time, I guess.
What about
the justice? You know, as you mentioned, there's been two coronial inquests. And yet, you know, there's nobody. No one's been charged.
And I think this is what really should make a lot of people angry, made me cross, that you can have very experienced magistrates who spend a lot of time at taxpayers' expense studying briefs of evidence. And in the second matter, in the second inquest, allocating 5 days of public hearings, bringing in numerous witnesses who have been interviewed by police, who have given statements, who've come in, given evidence under oath in those inquests, and the magistrates make findings. And those findings are very serious. You know, there's a high bar for a coroner to make a finding that a known person committed, you know, what was then murder. And that it should be considered for prosecution by the DPP. That's not something that they do lightly. And yet, when it gets to the office of the DPP, the system, as it currently works, is that a lawyer who has never been into the courtroom in which the inquest was conducted does what's effectively a desktop review of the evidence, an administrative review. They don't ever see or hear the actual witnesses giving evidence. They read their statements, and they might read the transcripts, or they might just read the submissions of the lawyer for the allegedly guilty person, saying, "Oh, these are the reasons why we don't think it should proceed." That's, you know, theoretically all that they might do. And so you have this secretive, closed door analysis of, but by a person of less stature and experience in many cases than the actual judge, you know, the magistrate who's run the inquest, making a decision that it won't be prosecuted. Well, what's the point of the inquest and the findings if you're going to have, you know, such an arbitrary, secretive approach without any accountability? It's just wrong. And I think that attorneys general around the country should reflect on that and just see whether it's actually serving justice to have such a an unaccountable process.
Have you been in touch with any of them?
Yeah, well, I've tried to talk to the New South Wales authorities, but it's in terms of, you know, the DPP and the legal, you know, the rule of law, on this case, they're, you know, very much closed door. You know, they don't want to describe what went on in this case or in any others. And again, you know, I'm probably sound like I'm a bit down on the DPP, but I think that in this case and in a number of others that I've investigated, they screw up, but they're not good at admitting their screw ups. And most times you never know that they've screwed up because it's all done behind closed doors. They have necessarily great independence, but with that, unfortunately, in my view, has become a lack of accountability.
I guess this case would be very different if there was a body, if Lynn Dawson's body had been found. You had there was the dig in September on the Bayview property. Nothing was found. What was your take on that? Were they not looking in the wrong place?
It was really disappointing.
I can understand that.
I was with Lynn's brother, Greg, when the police rang to say that they'd finished and they hadn't found her remains. And, you know, he's a very robust guy, and, you know, I could see the disappointment etched all over his face. We all had hopes that this could be resolved with a discovery. I was quietly confident, optimistic that there would be evidence and hopefully Lynn's remains on that block. And look, I guess it's possible that on such a big block, it's 1 acre, and they didn't, you know, and they couldn't turn over the whole block. I guess it's possible that they missed her, but I think they did a pretty thorough job in the target areas. And, you know, it was a dig that was long overdue. It should have happened, you know, many years ago. Where is she? Look, in my view, she's somewhere between Bayview and Southwest Rocks, and that's a very big area.
There's a lot of bush up there.
And there's a lot of bushland out the back, and the Kooringai National Park. And when I was down there in September, I went for some walks through that forest area and around Gilbinger Drive, and you know, there's been a lot of development since 1982 as well, but there's still, you know, vast areas of bushland that could conceal a body. I think that Lynn's family is adjusting to, you know, the probability that her remains will never be found, but that a prosecution is still very possible in the absence of a body.
Yeah, absolutely. And what about Teacher's Pet? It's episode 14. Yeah. And there hasn't been one since. So what's that, about a month ago?
It's probably about, eight weeks.
Eight weeks, sorry, I beg your pardon.
And we said we were going to take a break and let police go and get more statements and so on, let the DPP review it all. And I'd like to do some more episodes, and I'm working my way through that now. And I think it's okay to drop, you know, a couple of update episodes. It won't be a whole new series because I don't want to, you know, pad things out. But there's some new material, new information, new witnesses that I've talked to, and covering off on the dig is important. And I'm very keenly interested in that, and I've talked to Lynn's family about it, and they trust my judgment. So I'm hoping to do that certainly over the next before Christmas anyway, before mid-December, because in mid-December I'm planning to go away with my family for a while.
Well-deserved break. we're just about out of time, but does this story ever end, do you think, for you?
It's not going to end for a while, Peter, because I'm determined to just keep chipping away at it. It's probably the most important story I've done for a very, very long time. And it means a lot to me because of the people I've met along the way. One of the great things about all of the contacts I've made in this story is the friendships that have come out of it as well. I've met so many great people on the northern beaches, in particular, former students of Cromer High, people who've trusted me to tell their story, people who have been feeling very guilty and remorseful for years that they didn't do more, or that they didn't tell police what they told me as a result of hearing the podcast. And they are really determined to see it through now, and I am too. So I want to stay on this for as long as it takes, for as long as the paper will let me. There's a bit to go.
It's a fantastic series. You know, congratulations. I can't praise you more making it sound like it's a bromance, which I'm sure it is anyway. But look, Hedley, thank you for giving up some time for the Fourth Estate. That's about it for us for this week. We'll be back on next week with another episode. In the meantime, check us out on Twitter. Get ready for the podcast. And I'd like to thank you again, Hedley, for a great episode.
Well, thank you very much for having me, and it's probably beginner's luck in terms of podcasting, but I hope that for everyone out there thinking about doing a podcast, bear in mind, I didn't know anything about them. So as long as you have a great deal of conviction for the story, you believe in the story, you've got just an H2 enzyme, costs a couple hundred bucks, you can do this, and away it goes.
Well, on that fantastic piece of advice, that's it from the Fourth Estate for this week. Thanks for listening.